Welcome today to the Science Right Now podcast. I'm Amanda Niehaus, and today I have with me two playwrights. Stephen Carlton is Associate Professor of Drama at the University of Queensland. His plays have won the Patrick White Playwrights Award and the Griffin Award for Best New Australian Play, and have been produced in theatre companies across Australia. His climate change absurdist texts like The Turquoise Elephant and New Babylon are among the 100 plays to save the world. Oliver Goff is an emerging playwright and MPhil candidate in creative writing at the University of Queensland. He was a participant in PlayLab's 2021 incubator program, and his plays have been produced by UQ's Underground Theatre Company and at Brisbane's Anywhere Festival. Oliver's work interrogates climate change ravaged futures, using absurdism to conceive of the Anthropocene. You can also find an essay by Oliver in our latest edition of Science Right Now on the website. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much.
So I love the work that you both do in sort of examining climate change through an almost comical, absurdist, farcical way on the stage. And I would like to ask you both straight up, what do you feel is the role of absurdism in communicating climate change?
Sure. Stephen, do you want to?
I love absurdist theatre, and I always have. There's something about the bold theatricality that really appeals to me, and the humour of it. So I guess for me, it's an opportunity to use comedy and satire and the grotesque I don't mean this in a cheap way, but to laugh when we need to laugh in a gallows humour way at how dire things have become. And I think often the role of satire is to help, send messages out there in code almost to an audience that might be hostile to being preached at about, topics like this. So I love absurdism as a bold, rich, theatrical kind of, Trojan horse in that sense.
Mm. And Stephen, what are some of your favorite plays that use absurdism in any context?
Well, the very first piece of theatre I ever went to see, I won tickets. I grew up in Darwin, and I won tickets on the radio. I was the seventh caller. I've got this memory of it so clearly. I was in year seven. And I won tickets to the Darwin Theatre Group. It was, as it was then called, their production of Rhinoceros by Eugene Ionesco. So that was my first piece of theatre. That was the first play I ever went to see, and it happened to be an absurdist play. And so I that was my default. I think I thought that that's what theatre was supposed to be. I came to naturalism quite late, and I'm still a bit scared of it. So that was my first play, and I just remember I remember sitting in that theatre and the oral kind of sound of the rhinoceroses stampeding and being introduced to literary metaphor, this idea that one by one people in that European town are turning into rhinoceroses as they succumb to fascist ideology. I didn't have that political language, of course, as a 12-year-old, but I got the message. And subliminally, I realized with retrospect, it shaped my politics, and it's clearly shaped me as a playwright. And there's a bunch of other absurdist plays that I went on to study at university and teach too that I also loved. And that Oliver has also kind of connected to and written about in his academic work.
Mm. Yeah. I think for me, in terms of absurdism, connecting with absurdism early as well, I think, there's, as Stephen says, so incredibly bold, but the metaphors that can be used in those absurdist plays as well, things that like the rhinoceroses, things that just, are unafraid to be completely theatrical and outside the bounds of, what may be considered reasonable to actually happen, which I think a lot of theatre, is quite interested in and can do well. But I think there's something worthwhile in stepping outside of that as things that we didn't think were reasonable to happen are now happening, or certain people didn't think were reasonable to happen. So I think in the form as well, there's something that can be, you know, so useful for thinking about climate change. I think the way that the language sort of, a lot of writers have sort of said it decenters the human. It makes us realize how ineffective our communication can actually be at times. And it makes us, sort of realize that by showing, where communication can get us, you know, when we let ourselves go around in circles.
I like that about your writing, Oliver, and about absurdist writing generally. I forget that, yeah, that it is a theatre of language, as well as a theatre of image, and this idea, and quite transgressive language. What I love as a playwright and as an audience in this sort of theatre is how transgressive these plays are. They can be really vulgar. You know, they can speak the unspeakable. You get to kind of name the unmentionable, the taboo, the forbidden. It's quite gothic, in that sense. I think there's a real overlap between the gothic, and absurdism with these sorts of climate plays. I was just rereading the intro to the book that you mentioned, and your intro, Amanda, the 100 Plays to Save the World that Elizabeth Freestone and Jeannie O'Hare have just released. And they say that the sorts of plays, I think that Oliver and I are both writing a subgenre there of that these editors call eco-farce, and they say that it seems to be coming especially out of Australia, this genre of eco-farce, and whether there's something that's to do with how extreme and how obscene the climate crisis that we're experiencing is. You know, Australia seems to be almost emblematic in its, you know, bigger bushfires that you can see from space, floods that, you know, were unimaginable a few years ago. The climate crisis itself is obscene, and so for me, that gives you license as the playwright to create obscene characters plays that transgress good manners and taste as well.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a connection with the Australian sense of humour there too?
I suspect that might be part of it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And certainly the weather and the climate events we've been having here, I think they say in that book, there's a reason that some of the most ambitious in form and most sort of, wild and outrageous writing in this genre is coming from Australia.
And you know, I think that's something to do with, I also think that's linked to the fact that we were, I don't know, our theatre companies were amongst the last to start programming, climate change plays. And it's like that the elastic has stretched here. You know, we've been itching to artists and writers to say something and have the work programmed. You know, the longer that elastic kind of stretches while mirroring our government's kind of delayed response to doing, you know, to offering political solutions to climate change too, I would suggest, the absurdism of it kind of ramps up, the absurdism of not acknowledging this, of not doing anything about it, of not talking about it, you know, the elephant in the room, I suppose, this collective kind of weird silence around this topic that seems to have been the case on Australian theatre's main stages, with one or two exceptions. So maybe the extreme, that pushes, that generates an extreme kind of counter response as well. So the theatre has to be bold because, you know, we're screaming to be heard, and we're having to shout this message now rather than, you know, I don't know, do it in a heady intellectual, sensible British kind of way.
And do you think that sets theatre as an art form apart from the other ways that people talk about climate change through, you know, novels or even television?
Yeah. I think that, you know, for me, theatre is so public and it's so participatory, you know, that there's no escaping the fact that, you know, just by the form that you're in the room with everyone and you're seeing the bodies on stage doing, you know, doing what they're doing, the lines that they're speaking. And I think there's an immediacy there, which combined with, absurdism in form and climate change in content, allows audiences to be confronted with that fact, in a way that other forms, you know, sort of can't.
I wonder too if that heightened theatricality that we're talking about, it's bordering on the grotesque and bordering on the camp sometimes as well, whether that feels, when you transfer that to other mediums, whether it feels kind of cheesy and stagey and it doesn't work so well as a TV series or as a film. That seemed to be, what was that big kind of film, Don't Look Back, is that the one?
Yeah.
I keep getting the titles like that. That yeah. seemed to
Don't
polarize.
Look
Don't Look Up, thank you. That's it. That seemed to polarize audiences exactly along those sorts of lines. It actually felt like a stage play in tone to me, and so I quite liked it. It didn't aesthetically or stylistically seem to sit well with everyone.
Yeah,
I think there's a demand for there's been a growing demand for subtlety in film and on TV, which isn't necessarily required or even useful on stage.
Yeah, and I think with climate change, I like the idea of communicating using these different modes and means, because I think you're right. Like a lot of writing, I come from a more sort of fiction writing, novel, short story background, and so, you know, I'm working to like deeply embed any climate change messages so that, I actually had the privilege of working with a psychologist recently who's studying, climate change messaging and how different forms of messaging, sort of attract or repel readers. And, you know, we had a lot of negotiation about how deeply to embed the messages, because my natural instinct was to like hide them very, very, you know, subterranean level, to the point where she's like, I don't know if many people are going to catch that this is actually climate change. And so there's this feeling of, you know, how do you connect with people around these ideas? And I like the idea that there are actual, places like theater where you can connect on a very bold level. As you both have been doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I that's true. I think, neither of us in this style of play, this style of theatre, the absurdist theatre, it's not subtle theatre, you know, in that sense. But within that, you want to be subtle about other things. I don't know how Oliver feels about that, but, you know, I don't want my plays to be, leaden kind of didactic, message-based plays. I mean, there is obviously really obvious messaging happening in them, but I don't enjoy going to the theatre and being lectured to or at and harangued. I go to a lecture to be lectured at. You know, I write lectures when I want to lecture people. where that is a little bit trickier, I think, in theatre when you're talking about messaging is that the messaging that that we're hearing very clearly from theatre programmers and artistic directors at the moment is that this is a time for messages of hope. So we don't want your dark and dystopic plays about climate change. So there is a sense of please don't write plays in this style, but feel free to write styles plays in this style. And so unless your messaging is uplifting and doesn't frighten the subscribers away, we're not interested. So that's an interesting shift. And that's part of the reason I suppose we talk about these as dark comedies, but they're comedies nonetheless. But even then, at the moment, we're getting this pressure to kind of codify and offer hopeful solutions.
I could see maybe that one of the ideals would be that, you know, while they're in the theater, people come away with this like really sort of positive feeling from the comedic aspect. And then at some point later, it kind of hits them. Oh, actually, that's what that was. And that's what that means.
Yeah. Well, like it's bad that that's funny. It shouldn't be funny, but it is. Oh, no. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's necessary laughter as well. And I think that wariness about plays and that aren't about climate, that aren't hopeful, I suspect that that's underestimating the the adventurousness of audiences and their tastes. I reckon they're up for dark humor, you know, and you know, if you're not going to, what are your alternatives here? You know, if you don't feel like you can personally kind of fix things, you vote for someone who can. You know, you get solar panels and you know, you do the stuff you want to do. But I think that this is a, I don't know, I think that the recent Australian election at any rate has shown theatre company programmers that the sorts of audiences that they're afraid might be scared off by climate plays are the ones that most want to see it, quite possibly. You know, they're people living in the upper middle class, inner suburbs of Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne.
And I think there's been a potentially a slow or a fairly rapid actually shift in what a climate play actually sort of means, you know, from being sort of like purely about scientists trying to solve sort of global warming to stories where the reality of climate change is sort of embedded, you know, into various plot points, but also into the form as the sort of form of the play falls apart or is made strange or is, you know, impacted by, you know, weather and climate events. So I think what a hopeful play means, what a dark climate play means, what a climate play means at all is changing quite quickly. And it's becoming, you know, it's shooting off into lots of different areas and becoming a bigger field, you know, and sort of more, yeah, diverse and exciting as well.
I'd agree with that. I was interviewing or facilitating some conversations between other playwrights recently for a book project that my colleague Chris Hay and I are working on, and Andrew Bovell and David Finnegan, whose climate plays I admire and enjoy as well, and you know who are bold, theatrically risky writers as well. David was saying that you know, there's in you know, bouncing off what Oliver was suggesting there, you know, this question of what constitutes a climate play, and he was saying like almost any play now, any play that or piece of literature that's engaging with the world we live in now is on some level a climate change text. You know, if your characters are catching an international flight or driving a car, then even if the text isn't about climate change, the characters are participating in that conversation and in that conundrum. So, yeah, that's interesting. How do we define this genre? Where it's, you know, is it just plays that are explicitly about the climate crisis as a topic, or does that sit within everything that we write or read at the moment?
That actually segues really beautifully into a question that I wanted to ask both of you about some of your recent works, or in the case of the Turquoise Elephant, you know, fairly recent works. Can you tell us a little bit about the plays that you've written and maybe a little bit about how you embedded climate change ideals into, you know, character or plot or dialogue or on all of these different levels?
Sure.
Do you want to go first? Or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I guess so. For me, the play that I'm working on at the moment, Concrete Mirage, which is for my thesis. It's about, you know, it's very explicitly about, you know, sort of post climate disaster. And I've chosen to set it, you know, in a sort of local recognizable urban setting of Brisbane where I live. And it's about a group of sort of climate activists, I guess, or from a larger grouping of sort of left-wing activists who return to the city post climate disaster after there's been an evacuation, and decide to, you know, they're going to be the, you know, the group that's going to begin an ethical, you know, an ethical sort of green repopulation, rejuvenation of the city. And they choose the sort of, you know, they're anti-capitalist. They choose the sort of symbolic nucleus of capitalism, Commonwealth Bank on Queen Street, to sort of ironically move in there and start their revolution. And they sort of, they you know, quite quickly fall into the traps of their own bureaucratic organization, which, you know, sort of mirrors the failed bureaucracy of the city, Brisbane City Council, which is sort of present in bizarre sort of distorted PA messages. And also, yeah, the egos of the activists, you know, their firmly held, you know, ideas and theories, which they can't seem to sort of break free of and become practical. And then sort of another competing, group in the city who sort of believe that, who are climate change deniers, who don't think that it's real, who think that it's a bad season, and sort of the clashes between those groups. And of course the, you know, the forbidding climate that they're in, the overheated CBD, which I was sort of drawn to by these sort of terrifying heat maps of how hot these concrete enclosed areas are becoming, and how the greener suburbs comparatively are faring much better, and how you know, there's more to explore there. The play, you know, I'm sort of still working on it, still creating new drafts, but how class plays into that, and how, you know, that, as we know, climate change disproportionately affects people who contribute the least to the problem itself, and this idea that, you know, walled concrete urban settings, you know, are really going to bear the brunt compared to the larger, you know, larger suburbs on the outside with huge houses and trees. Yeah, and in terms of the, you know, the scientific concepts and the concepts of climate change within it, I tried to use the form and the absurdist, language to try to portray that, the breakdown of their communication, repetition, slippage between characters, the set and the sort of city falling apart as the climate, as the impacts of climate change intensify. Though of course it's, you know, massively there in the content. It is about climate change and post climate change disaster, but, I tried to use both, and use the form as the thing that really pushes the impacts of the climate change on this group, as well as their organization, which falls apart. So I'm not sure that it quite fits into that, request for hopeful plays, that seems to be echoing, across artistic directors, but, I think there is, there's some hope in there, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite characters is the real estate agent.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that character?
Okay. Yeah. So this is sort of, there are random sort of glitches or hangovers from the old system, the old, system of organization in the city, and the group are in this Commonwealth Bank, and they're sort of rudely interrupted by an irate real estate agent who doesn't know exactly what's happened, wonders where the people are, and sort of demands bills and rent and water and utilities, and returns multiple times. So there, yeah, I guess I have tried to, you know, sort of include the comic and the absurd as well. And, obviously that's not, probably not something that could reasonably happen decades after climate change disaster, but, yes, it's a hangover from the old system and a representation of how bizarre that system really is when you think about it. Someone trying to live in a place and, being demanded of money just for existing, I guess.
Yeah, I felt like she kind of took the role that lawyers take sometimes of being the one that, like, nobody really likes, that sort of that person, because they abide by a completely sort of, outset set of rules that don't apply anymore. And
And well, the language and the repetition of, if you just had an email exchange with a real estate agent, it's very absurdist and bizarre. So there's just these set tropes and sayings that are so easy to just embed, and you just say them twice in a row and it seems ridiculous. So,
It's like the absurdity of bureaucratic language, right? Those characters are kind of bureaucrats that, you know, let's get bogged down in semantics and red tape rather than actually addressing.
semantics that don't have real meaning to them.
Yeah.
Using language that kind of floats in this place of ambiguity.
Which you can fall into even if you have, you know, good intentions, as I think the activists in the play do. I guess it's about being radical, being more radical, you know.
Stephen, can you talk a little bit about the turquoise elephant?
Sure. Yeah, it's the first of three climate change plays that I've written. The first two being The Turquoise Elephant and New Babylon, and New Babylon is a sequel to that play. And then the third one, Brutal Utopias, is a completely different sort of style and genre. It's more of a naturalistic political play, I guess. I think as a set of three plays, they kind of map my shifting relationship to the climate crisis. My deep fondness for The Turquoise Elephant as the first of those three plays is that I think it came out of a sense of, just this burning urgency, and frustration about the then government and Murdoch media in Australia's collective kind of position of climate denial. You know, it was written in 2015 in the lead up to the Paris Agreement, I think. And that was just the political frustration of Australia's response to that important international meeting was really fueling the writing of that. And I was literally taking grabs from, you know, the Australian each day from their op-ed pages and whacking them into the voices of the various characters who had power and influence within the text of the play. So it's a riff on the absurdity of the denialist position, which I felt that we were then in, which I don't think we're in anymore. I think we've come out of denial, but are being absurd in other ways now. So it looks at a particularly privileged family, the Macquarie family, and the family matriarch. Augusta is a former Governor General of Australia and a very, very wealthy fossil fuel industry dynasty. The climate crisis in Australia, it's set in a near future. I call it now, with the dial turned up. It's set in Sydney, but Melbourne has just flooded, like in the hour before the play begins. And and Augusta's granddaughter lives with her in this shrine, you know, a triple glazed house on the harbour, on Sydney Harbour, looking over the Opera House and Harbour Bridge. It's a very privileged family. But Basra, the granddaughter, is a climate change activist. She's the Gothic princess in the tower in the play, and calls herself that at one point. She's raging and railing and wanting to do something with the family's money to at least assist the climate change refugees from Melbourne, where the sea level rise has gotten into the subways the sewerage system is, the city is quite literally drowning in its own shit there. So, that's kind of the opening chaos of the play. So it's that, you know, it's looking at, Oliver was saying that a climate crisis disproportionately hits those who have least been culpable for creating it, right? But here we have this, I wanted to look at privilege and who's in the power, who's in the position of power to do something about this because they have the means, but who's also probably been even more culpable of creating the problem in the first place. So yeah, so that's it. That's the scenario. There's an extremely wacky, almost ageless aunt, Olympia, who enters the fray. She's a dark tourism person. She is not a climate change denialist. I call her a climate hedonist. She travels the world, you know, watching the Kilimanjaro snow melts and the glaciers melting. She'd be in Switzerland right now this morning. I just saw that a particular glacier in Switzerland is about to melt for the first time in centuries. That would be her. That would be Aunt Olympia, like just kind of lusting after the voyeurism of that. She has a boyfriend who's, I don't know, about 50 years younger than her, called Jeff. He's a weird cult leader who's kind of picking and choosing who he wants to help repopulate the earth on the other side of the crisis. So I guess I would call him a climate opportunist. And then there is the climate, the activist there. The family have, there's a set of identical twins who work as domestic help inside the family, but who are secretly, assassins and climate change activists who blow things up, Vissi and Vika. So five different characters who each for me represent a different position in relation to the climate crisis, and I wanted to put them in a hot house together and see them scrap it out.
No, that's brilliant. I love it. And I actually to read your play is so much fun. The dialogue is just so snappy and interesting, and I think it should be required reading, actually.
That's very kind of you to say, Amanda. Thank you. I have recently been giving workshops, and this actually sits within Oliver's thesis, just a transparency declaration. I'm supervising Oliver's master's thesis. This is how I know so much about what he's writing about. I've been giving some masterclasses for Queensland drama teachers, looking at ways that to revamp the curriculum a bit, to introduce climate change texts into their classes, even when there isn't a climate change curriculum as such. You know, so how to kind of sneak climate change plays into the existing curriculum, and looking at ways to rethink theatre of the absurd as a drama module with green plays, so greening the theatre of the absurd, and also a second module in the senior Queensland syllabus is Australian Gothic drama. So I've been teaching, looking at ways that teachers can introduce climate change plays into that module as well. And I think that Oliver's more expert than I am in this area, but there's been a recent academic project by Carl Lavery and Claire Finborough, that is encouraging us to rethink that mid 20th century absurdist theatre of the absurd tradition, to rethink it as a green module, that they are looking at ways to rethink that whole movement with a green lens on.
That's really exciting. Oliver, does this relate to your master's thesis topic? Do you want to talk a little bit more? Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I guess in terms of like the idea of greening the absurd, I think that's something that, like current climate plays are very much attracted to doing and can do. But also something that, you know, I think they argue that some of the original absurdist plays were sort of implicitly sort of doing that already, you know, with those ideas of decentering the human against the environment, this idea of like staging the future where the sky does fall on our heads, that sort of thing. So this idea that we we're not all powerful as humans. We're not all knowing as humans. We can't even, communicate with each other properly, and we have problems with each other. How can we claim to be sort of, omnipotent on the planet and to know what the planet, what's happening with the planet, where what's happened before us and what's even happening now. But I think that the idea of the Anthropocene, in that book, I think it sort of shows that that's not being anthropocentric. I think we're starting to realize that this is an epoch that has necessarily been, defined by our sort of destruction of the environment. And there is something, absurd, strange and ironic in us sort of finally realizing that and sort of telling ourselves that. And then the idea to move forward with the same system, the same ideas that got us there in the first place, is absurd and strange. So, trying to think of how to break from that, is important, I think, is something that absurdist writing can, if not suggest how to save the world, a stock taking of the situation, at least, and the ironies of the situation, I think, from which, further action would be better off from there.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to there's quite a, that's part of quite an exciting literary project that I think is happening at the moment, just as in the 90s, with the rise of post-colonialism, suddenly, academics and scholars and artists were going back and looking at the whole Western canon and looking for the retrospectively looking for the post-colonial themes or with that second wave of feminism, you go back and you reread Shakespeare through a feminist lens, then go back and kind of, reread the canon through a queer lens. I think at the moment there's a rereading of the canon through a green lens taking place, and you realise that just as it's been sitting there in the theatre of the absurd, in the way that Oliver talks about, well, maybe we can go back even further and look at, look at Shakespeare for his green themes. Reread The Tempest as an ecological play. Go back and look at Chekhov and reread Uncle Vanya and The Cherry Orchard as ecological or cli-fi plays. So yeah, it's an interesting, all sorts of interesting new and scope for all sorts of new postgrad and academic research projects coming out of that.
Yeah, and as someone, so I don't come from a literary background, and so for me, I'm curious, what does it give us to reread these very old texts in these new lenses? What does that,
how do you do it, or?
Well, what does it tell us about who we were then and who we are now to do that?
Right. I guess it tells us that we knew that we were creating these problems all along, and that it's taken us, I don't know, however many hundreds of years to kind of work it out and do something about it. When I think about climate crisis, this sits outside of literature, I suppose, but I think one thing that just kind of breaks my heart, is that I link to colonialism, is just the destruction of all of those ancient forests in Europe in the 1500s and 1600s to create ships, to go and kind of colonize the rest of the world. That was the first big act of large-scale economic vandalism in Europe for me. Others talk about the Anthropocene as beginning from the moment that we first, the Industrial Revolution began, or the moment that humans first started kind of altering the environment in any way. So some people call the advent of farming being the beginning of the climate crisis. So it depends on your position there. But I think we can go back and look at texts from all of those periods. They're not necessarily about that. But Uncle Vanya, for instance, is about, it is about Chekhov kind of mourning what the Industrial Revolution is doing to the forests of Russia. It is, that playwright is, even in the, in 1900 or so, is worried about economic, environmental vandalism. So those concerns are there in, at least in plays from the past, and most definitely literature from the past as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, even if it's not explicitly, you know, critiquing environmental destruction as well, this this idea of the human ego as sort of driving us to places that we want to go but we shouldn't go, is there for so long, you know, from some of the earliest writing. And I think that, you know, fits really nicely with, you know, with being ecological and with ecological writing. And of course with theatre as well, there's, you know, potential for adaptation, you know, and new stagings of old works. And if you're going back, and it's exciting to find and see, oh, this is actually ecological. This actually fits with the climate crisis, this, you know. And then of course, you know, new stagings can come from those older texts.
So long as they don't stop programming new writing. Maybe if they at least if the companies at least conscript Australian qualified playwrights into doing those adaptations.
Not too many straight up restagings of old texts. I'm not going to be the advocate for that.
How many more excuses to program Shakespeare do we need to give people?
That's true.
It's really interesting because I had never actually, it just occurs to me that I haven't really thought about when the Anthropocene began. I guess in my mind, it's kind of, it sits somewhere between the Industrial Revolution and the 80s. And, and so, yes, I find that fascinating that, you know, we look to art, to sort of find the boundaries of ideas throughout history. Like when did people start thinking about these things, and when did the social mind kind of start shifting in a particular direction? That's really amazing.
And when did the grieving begin, you know, and when did the horror begin?
Absolutely.
I think one of the reasons it's hard to keep up with when or have an idea, clear idea of when the Anthropocene started is that it's so constantly intensifying so quickly. You know, you're talking about the 80s and, you know, the digital age, and it's just constantly leaping forward. Neoliberalism, it's constantly intensifying and redefining itself.
Yeah, and that's right. And we're engaged in this, you know, if we were literary writers rather than playwrights, I guess you would call this genre, you wouldn't call it absurdism, you'd call it speculative fiction, or you know, something closely related to that, cli-fi maybe, or I don't know, magic realism or something. But that's right, it is escalating so quickly, and that's the interesting thing about now, and devastating thing about now, is it feels like we're living in the future. It feels like all of those centuries of behaviour, wherever you define the Anthropocene as having begun, you know, whether it's from the first farm, the first coal mine, the first nuclear hydrogen bomb, or, you know, the first forest being felled for ships. We're paying the price now, where the piper is being paid now. We're living in this age where the worst imagined future horrors are happening and unfolding in real time in an escalating sense of drama. Mm. So, I guess, how can you not kind of, I don't know, how can you not be writing with alarm when that's the case?
And I think we're getting close to finishing up, and before we do, I'd love to hear from both of you about if there's anything you're working on or reading or engaging with at the moment that's really exciting for you.
I am, but it's not about climate change.
Tell us,
probably,
Stephen.
It's probably not worth talking about that. But I guess my most recent work, it only came out two months ago, Brutal Utopias. I guess that's the most recent engagement, that shift in style that I was talking about earlier, moving from absurdism to naturalism. I'm scared of naturalism as a playwright because I'm terrified of boring an audience. And I know that I love so much naturalistic theatre, novels, television shows, films that, you know, that don't in the least bore me, but I'm afraid that I will bore if I kind of, you know, operating in that mode. But I think I've, yeah, for me, I've moved from the absurd to the natural because I think something in my relationship with the climate crisis has changed. I've gone from, I think I've moved from, if you talk about the how many stages of grieving are there? Seven, five? I've moved from denial, to anger, although I sit in that sometimes, to grief, you know, and, you move in and out of these phases, right? But there's a pragmatist in me that is also in, also wrestling with the acceptance stage, I think, of this whole grieving process. You know, my most recent play was, okay, look, it's happening. What are we going to do about it? You know, there's no point in having more conversations about, you know, is it a climate crisis? Are we the ones who created it or not? It's just, you know, like that. So that's moot. We're in it, you know, so let's fix it. So that's a play about architects and engineers, who are having to just pragmatically, you know, in that place, stop New York from flooding by building a conceptual seawall around the island of Manhattan. I guess I'm in the process of wrestling, having a debate between the idealists and the pragmatists, because that's where I'm at. I swing between those positions.
And how about you, Oliver?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm going through Concrete Mirage again and sort of, I guess also, wrestling with a different kind of sort of twin impulses between, you know, wanting to be, you know, ambitious and challenging and sort of, really challenging with form and with how the world of the play falls apart, with this idea that I'm sort of working on of planned obsolescence and the city as a piece of planned obsolescence built for maximum profit and then just completely falling apart towards the end. I'm really interested in the idea of planned obsolescence as something that's you know, become so much more common as you know, as the years have gone by. I think most people would probably, you know, find examples from that with you know, items that they bought and then sort of made to buy again.
And also that connect with what Stephen was saying about the social classes, because like you have to be able to afford to buy the things that can last.
Right. Yeah.
The chilling thing about that, the thing I love about that, it's not just, you know, it's not just our washing machines and fridges. It's us. You know, there's a planned, it's like we've built a planned obsolescence for ourselves as a species into this, into late capitalism.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's scary that that's something that works so well for late capitalism, this idea of things not working and having to buy them again, because it's not really for people or for us. I guess it's for profits. So yeah, I'm sort of, wrestling with form and that idea as well as, you know, the desire to write, you know, satisfying characters, and satisfying character arcs and a story that has some answers, you know, which I know, is nice, you know, in the theater and that, you know, to a certain extent, maybe there should always be, you know, a place for or some sort of, you know, some sort of satisfaction, right, in a story or a play on stage, not just completely, all over the place. So yeah, just wrestling with those two, impulses and trying to marry them together in a way that says what I want to say, you know, in the work, as well as, offer a glimmer of hope or a glimmer of, you know, an argument, some sort of message or approach. Yeah.
Practical solutions, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's where we're at at the moment. We're hanging on to the thought that there might be practical solutions for all of this.
I suppose that's what makes us write in that way in the first place, that it's such a difficult situation and so many, you know, anxieties pulling at you. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really great place to finish up for today. And I just want to say thank you both, Stephen and Oliver, for being part of the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about our work, Amanda.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Science Right Now is sponsored by the Australia Council for the Arts, hosted by Amanda Niehaus and Jessica White, and produced by Taylor Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.